awareness through the heart. And I thought it would be really beautiful to bring them.
Thank you, Spirit Rock, for having us here. My name is Bruce Davis. Receive and enjoy what the three of us know have to give. Story, because hopefully it will inspire your story. In the early 1970s, I was in graduate school in psychology, and that was a very exciting time in those days. There was all these new therapies, Gestalt therapy, primal therapy, transactional analysis, rebirthing. I was involved in all of this. And experiencing all of this, and we thought, wow, this is a new world, you know. Nobody really talked about feelings that much before those days. You didn't really go into your feelings. And I was involved in these programs. I started the first primal therapy program in a minority community center in Denver, Colorado. That was a big deal that poor people, people of color, would come in and experience their early feelings. And we started something called the Denver Feeling Center. And you would come to the door, and we'd ask you, how old are you today? And you say, well, I feel about four. Okay, all the four-year-olds go up there. We got toys for the four-year-olds. And then you'd come in the door and say, oh, I'm just a little baby. I really don't know how I feel. And we sent the infants up to another room where we had toys for the infants. And then somebody else would come in and say, I'm a teenager. I'm really hanging out. I'm having fun. All right, or I'm a teenager and I hate the whole world. All right, we send the haters of the whole world up to a room and those who want to hang out and have fun to another room. And we thought this was the new world, you know, that we were not just serious adults, but that there's an inner child. Anyway, a long story short, I wrote a book called The Magical Child Within You, and it was about the inner child, but more than that, most of these therapies were discovering the painful inner child, how much I hated mom and dad and the neighbors and my dog and everybody else, you know? And that was where we were at. No, we got in touch with all of our feelings and all of our pain. But after going through primal therapy for a few years, I began asking, well, what about the fun inner child? You know, our humor, our joy, our imagination. And so I wrote this book, The Magical Child Within You. And I'm told it was the first book on the inner child. But I don't really feel it's from me. We were part of a movement in those days. And it was all coming out of those all those different therapies. And so that was a new frontier to be in my young 20s and exploring this inner child, the magical child within. And then I was at a seminar, and there was a lady in this seminar who was a shaman. And in those days, I didn't know what a shaman was. And one night I was asleep, and she came into my room and sat on the edge of the bed. And it was one of those really clear dreams, you know, like you're sitting, standing there. And I was just startled. And the next morning I went to her, and before I said anything, she said, do you remember me coming to you last night? And she said, I've been expecting you, and you will be my student. This was all very new for me. For years, I became her student, and she would come into my dreams and teach me my dreams and take me to dream classes. I was raised in a normal family that believed when you die, that's it. You live in the memories of the people who love you. And I hope there's more than that for my mom and dad now, because I don't think about them that much. I mean, I love my parents, but they live on, you know. But I keep our belief system that when you die, that's it. And but with this teacher, when she took me in these dream worlds, she would take me to the other side, and that was quite startling for me because I didn't know what another side was. That was before all these books were out and all these movies and videos about near-death experiences. So I was just being taken to the other side, and I was in a room on the other side that was just a it was a classroom. But it had no walls, and it was a very, very bright light. And in this classroom, there's about, maybe 10 or 15 of us there. some of us, I could feel that we're normal people in this classroom, and some of them were spirits in the classroom, and there was no teacher. There was just this light. There's no walls. And I would sit there, and you would ask a question, and it would be given to you out of the light. And this went on, off and on, for many years. And the person next to you, you could also feel what the question they asked and get their answer just intuitively. You just feel it. And it's hard to describe this light, but it changed me profoundly, and it still changes me. And I feel we all have experiences of this light in our own way. And if you're going to talk about heart practices and a heart-based light, it's really coming back to our original light. Now, this teacher was very amazing. She was raised in Samoa. And in Samoa, when the little village she was from, every nursing mother was her mother, and every father was her father. As a psychologist, that had a profound effect on me. I understood how she had all these gifts because there was so much love. You know, we all have limited, our gifts are limited because most of us only had one mother and one father, and they weren't so perfect, and they're all doing the best they can. But imagine having 20, 30 mothers loving you, nursing you, 20, 30 fathers caring for you, holding you, and that's natural. You grow up in that, all that abundant love. And when she talked about that, I felt that I understood why she was very close to this light, because the light inside of her was never dimmed, you know, it was never put out. When her mother was busy or not feeling well, there's a lot of other mothers in the village, you know, and all the kids were one family. But another interesting part of her story was that as the Japanese were approaching World War II, her real parents came forward and they had to make a decision about what to do with her and where they're going to go. And a long story short, they went in the wrong direction. And she was captured by the Japanese, and she had a very, very difficult life in a concentration camp. And she barely survived that, but she did survive. And by the time I had met her, all that whole story was over, of course, and she was now a shaman for the Eskimos in Alaska. So she would come visit me, oh, three or four times a year, and then physically, and then frequently in dreams, and I'd write letters back. And she said, "Bruce, you're my most stubborn student." And the reason why I think that was is because, you know, in our culture, our personality is so strong. You know, it's really difficult to stay close to our light, to our heart. I was raised, what was important in my family, my brothers all went to Ivy League schools. I got two brothers, and they had good grades. I did not go to an Ivy League school. One is a top lawyer in Washington, D.C., big corporate lawyer, on some list of the 100 top lawyers in the country. The other brother is a big hotshot architect making great big buildings in New York and Miami and L.A. And I was just Bruce. And I went to a little college in upstate New York. But it was so deep in our culture, this idea of self-importance and what you do and what are you going to do. My parents always asked, "What are you doing now?" Not really how do you feel, but what are you doing? And when I talked to them about my businesses, "How's your business?" Well, after going through this experience with the shaman, it really wasn't, you know, I couldn't really see myself as a business anymore. You know, and what I did was not so important. So with my first wife, we weren't doing much. I had a dream during that time because I was taught through dreams and learned through dreams. So I met my first wife in a dream. And then I met her actually physically about 9 months later and immediately recognized her from the dream. And these kinds of things are normal in other cultures. But in our culture, it's not normal. And me being really a normal kid from Denver, Colorado, I was the most stubborn student this poor teacher had. So my first wife and I, we wrote a little book called Hugs and Kisses. And because my parents were asking, "What are you guys going to do to make a living, you know?" And this little book called Hugs and Kisses became a big seller and sold over 500,000 copies. Every Valentine's Day was on the front counter, you, most of you are probably too young to know about this, but in the 70s, it was a big deal. And we would get a royalty check every 6 months that would cover most of the living expenses for the next 6 months. And a lot about connecting to your heart is connecting to our trust. Self-importance. It's not really what we do. You know, I know very wealthy people who have no trust. And we have close friends who live hardly any money, who have no money, and they're full of trust. We have friends who are my age now, you know, in their 60s or 70s, and they have no money, and they live in complete trust. And I know others who have, like, big bank accounts, and they're totally freaked out about what's going to happen with the stock market. And so a lot of this life of the heart was based on trust, and that never ends. You know, that's part of the human experience, to stay close to our heart and close this trust. So coming out of this experience, I really was having, to be honest with you, I was having difficulty living in American culture because there's not much support. In this great big light, we are completely naked. You know, there is no self-importance. It doesn't exist. We're just are. And there's not much support in our culture for this kind of nakedness. And even in the different religions and all the practices they teach, it's you don't hear much word about nakedness. You know, when you study the saints, you know, the Buddhist Rinpoches and the Catholic saints, they were all profoundly naked. So we went to the Philippines for a while and lived with the healers in a remote village. And these poor people, you know, they're very rich in their community. They're very rich in their nakedness. They're very rich. Even though we were only in the Philippines for a few months, this had a profound effect on us. The table of the family we were living with, they were so poor that they always served us our meal first to make sure that we had enough, and then what was left, they would feed the rest of the family. That was very humbling. And we didn't even know that was going on for a while, and then we caught on. We thought they just served us first and they ate later. But we realized why they did that, that they didn't have much food. So they always served us first, make sure there was enough for us, and then they served the rest of the family. And then in the Philippines, this village, the people were so poor, they used just their light for healing. They did laying on of hands and psychic surgery, and we were trained and lived in all this, and they were just so loving. They had nothing, but they had so much. You know, religion was real for them. It was not intellectual. It was literal. There would be, you know, angels visiting and spirits visiting, and this was normal. You know, it wasn't something that just only happens to saints. This was normal, and this had a profound effect on us. I remember after being there for a couple months, we went out of the village back into Manila to our first movie, and we saw our first movie, and oh my God, the energy from the movie after you've been away from media for a long time is so. Is so powerful because you're so open and so naked. The movie stayed with us for like 5 days. You know, normally now I go to a movie and it's no big deal. After an hour or two, you recover somehow if you can handle all the noise and stuff. But I just remember coming back from that movie. And when we came back from the Philippines, I remember sitting in San Francisco airport and the people were racing by and I was wondering, where are you going? I mean, everybody's so fast. And this was before the internet and all this energy now that you have everything immediately. And so what we did was we started opening our house every Thursday night, inviting people to come sit with us. And somehow the word spread. And we did this for like 10 years. And every Thursday night, maybe one or two or sometimes four or five people would come. And there was another Thursday night that nobody came. And that was a real teaching, a commitment. So part of the heart practice is it's an ending. You always have to trust. That never ends, no matter how shot we think we are. we're still trusting. And the second thing was a commitment to a practice that feels right with you. So through the years, my practice has always changed. But in those days, it was a commitment to every Thursday night. We were there. We opened our house to whoever came. We didn't charge any money. And we just sat there. And we didn't teach. We didn't teach meditation or anything. We just sat in the silence and received our own hearts, our own light. That builds our spiritual body. And you get stronger. And through the years, really neat people came, you know, and would hug us, and we would hug them, and there was community. And from a little room in this little cottage, we grew community here in Marin County. And we used to have like 100 people coming every Sunday to sit, support each other, and trusting the path. So long story short, I wrote a book about the shaman, the magical child was the book, and then there was a book called The Heart of Healing, which we first published it ourselves, and my parents were not very impressed. But then Bantam came in and published the same exact book with the same cover. Nothing had changed. But my mother said, you know, it's a much better book now. It's really a good book. And, you know, if Bantam publishes it, then you must be okay, you know? And it's just so much about our culture. Anyway, the Bantam bestseller introduced us to a lot of beautiful people around the world because it came out in different languages. And we were invited to Europe. And my first night in Europe, I had a dream because, you know, I'm learning through dreams. And I was in this great big valley. And a bird landed on my shoulder. And there's just this incredible peace. And it's like this peace on the other side, you know. It's a peace that has no end. Thinking about St. Francis. Now, I was not raised Christian, so I never really thought about St. Francis. But my friends told me, you know, Bruce, there's a place in Italy that has that feeling, that exact feeling. You should go there. It's the home of St. Francis. So in those days, we were traveling around and through Europe and America and Japan, and I was telling everybody about this dream. You know, we're all in this together. We're doing the best we can. We're trusting. And so the first time we went to Assisi, Italy, we had 88 people from 11 countries. And I never thought I'd find a place in Western culture that would support my light. You know, because I'm not an Eskimo shaman, you know. I'm not from these other cultures, and I love them, and the people are beautiful, but if it's not in you deeply, it's not the same. You know, I was not raised with 30 mothers and 30 fathers. But St. Francis is from our culture, and St. Clair, and so it was very special for me personally to find this in our culture, this feeling, this peace without end. St. Francis had a heart without end. And a lot of his process is what we all go through. It's a big undressing. Now, he came from a wealthy family, and I was really interested in his process as a psychologist and personally, you know, how do we get to this state, this light that we really can hold on and just trust and enjoy this light? And the main thing about St. Francis is the prayer, Lord, make me an instrument. You know, so that's the third thing. Commitment to a practice. And the third thing is, Lord, make me an instrument. Because the ego is so strong. You know, we don't even know it. And there's nothing wrong with a strong ego. I mean, it's just our personality. But our personality is a heavy blanket between us and the light. We think the personality is normal, but the personality is really just clothing. It's just a shirt. It's not who we are. And to make your shirt important, it's not really wet. Because underneath the shirt, your body is so much light. I mean, just incredible. So much peace. So I was really interested how St. Francis worked from our stubborn minds to our soft little heart. And it's mainly that prayer, Lord, make me an instrument. Because that really helps defeat our importance and all these things that we want to do or we think are special or whatever. You just keep that prayer going on. So, Lord, make me an instrument. It's also just this life of service. During this time, Ruth and I began a project of service of feeding homeless people in San Francisco. Every Friday night at my house with our little kid, we'd make 300 to 500 sandwiches, and we worked with a very wealthy school nearby here, and we'd go in the streets of San Francisco and feed people living on the streets. And that was very humbling. That was very real. Because every day when you feed them, it was just by chance I'm the one making the sandwiches and not receiving the sandwiches. You know, we all think that we're very far away from the people receiving the sandwiches, but we're not so far away. St. Francis taught me this, you know. St. Francis kissed the leper. You know, it's very beautiful. And in those days also, Mother Teresa was just happening, and she was really the first person in a big public way to kiss the leper, you know, to really be with the poor. And I used to spend time with her sisters. She has sisters right here in San Francisco in the Formation House, so I was a lay brother with them, and we would come there every week, and these sisters were so beautiful. You would sit with them, and they'd have adoration of the Eucharist. I don't know if you know, if you're Catholic, you know what this is, but it's where you really pour your heart out to God. And the sisters would sit in this room and just pour out their heart. And when they were doing that, they were like shining. It was just really a big blessing to sit in the same room as these sisters. In our culture, we don't really pour out our hearts much, a little bit to our partners and to our children. But pouring out your heart is a big spiritual practice. And I learned it first from these sisters. And then Jocelyn, during this time, spent a lot of time in India visiting a great big, beautiful saint named Sathya Sai Baba. And we all have judgments about the Catholic Church, and we all have judgments about gurus and stuff. But in the Catholic Church is this adoration of pouring out your heart. So with trust and commitment and service, the pouring out the heart is really a big practice. When you pour out your heart, you're washing our personality. You're washing your mind. Unfortunately, it comes back. I mean, my personality never went away. My wife teaches me this all the time, that my personality is still here. But after a while, you take your personality less seriously. And that's a big secret. You know, after all the primal therapy I did and all these other therapies, it was still there. After all, you know, the different heart practices, you know, the personality doesn't go away, but it gets a little thinner. And when you're in this great big light, you realize that the personality is only this big. It's just one shirt. It's not what life is all about. But through this shirt, through the personality, you experience the beauty of the world. And so St. Francis discovered beauty. And that is also a spiritual practice. I took groups to Assisi, Italy for 30-40 years, three times a year from all over the world. And eventually we lived there for 12 years. My wife said, well, why would you leave here? And she was right. I mean, if this is really where your home is, why would you leave? So we lived there, and my friends, my priest friends, says, you're really extremely naive or blessed, because we moved to Italy without speaking the language and not knowing that it's really another world. But anyway, we lived in Assisi, Italy for 12 years, and during that time, my wife started this, it's like a community, of blessing people as little flowers. We had people visiting us from all over the world, and she would take time and wash them with waters from different parts of the world and bless them as a little flower. And being a little flower is also another heart practice. That you realize, you know, we're only here. I still think I'm 25, but I'm no longer 25. And we're only here for this long. And being a little flower means that we realize life is really short, and you want to give all your colors. That's what we're here for. So we each give all of our colors the best we can. And my wife started this movement, and it's now in 17 countries, 100 and 150 people. The idea of little flowers doesn't matter how big the garden is. If there's just two little flowers, it's beautiful. If there's three flowers, four flowers, you know, it's beautiful because we're little flowers and we're giving all that we can. And this idea of the little flowers came from St. Francis and St. Clair. That's how their movement grew. It was a heart-based little flowers. And I don't know if you know much about St. Francis and the history of religion, but he profoundly changed the church. He brought in the resurrected Christ instead of the crucified Christ. He brought in the feminine into the church more than it's ever been. And the worship of nature and appreciation of nature. And Claire and Francis brought in this great love. Love was a reflection of this light that's inside of us. Francis spent a lot of time on caves in mountaintops. And during the many years living in Italy, we went and stood and lived in these caves and spent time there. And slowly, slowly, we became friends with silence. Silence, it washes our thoughts. It washes our personality. You can't be too serious in the silence, you know? Everything comes to you in the silence, including what's on your mind. But underneath our mind, there's something else. There's just awareness or presence. So during these years, we came more and more close to silence. And it's listening to the silence of the heart. To the silence of the heart. Another big chapter of my life, and I'll close with this chapter because I don't want to bore you or anything, but in the early, in 1976 was the first time on the way to the Philippines we stopped in Bali. In those days, Bali was very different than it is now. But ever since then, we've been going back to Bali many times. And Bali in Indonesia, spirituality, the people are so peaceful. Men are softer and more open and more available than even most women in our culture. And the women are all. Bali, the babies do not touch the ground for the first 9 months. They're either held by mom or dad or another. In our culture, the mother and the father want to get back to work as soon as possible. And there's this energy of wanting to get back to work as soon as possible. When my daughter got pregnant, she was at the University of Berkeley, and all of her friends said, "What do you mean you're pregnant? What about your career?" There was not one of her friends who celebrated that she was pregnant, that she's a mother, and how beautiful. The light on the other side is very, very close to the energy of the mother, the perfect mother. So a big part of our path, and a big part of the path of Francis and Claire and always, has been this incredible devotion to the mother, because God loves us like a mother. God is a mother of this infinite amount of arms and this incredible love. That's just, you know, those of us who are parents, we love our kids regardless. I mean, we get angry once in a while, but it's no big deal. I mean, the love is so deep. I mean, it's just incredibly deep. Well, this light room, this place on the other side, it's that times a thousand. That's what the other side is. It's this love times a thousand. And so we can only take it in little bits unless you're raised by 30 mothers and 30 fathers. But in Bali, what happens is that the first thing the kids learn after they're held for 9 months, they go to temple and they do this prayer that I'm going to share with you. And starting at age two, they go, there's a temple in every house in Bali. Imagine having a temple in every house in America. And there's a temple in every village, every other village. There's 10,000 temples on the little island. And the prayer on this is, the first part of the prayer is, "I remember emptiness." Age two, they start this prayer. And then the second part of the prayer is, "I offer everything to the one God." Everything. Third part of the prayer is that "I offer everything to the manifestations of God. My family is a manifestation. Even feel the cars are a manifestation. Everything is a manifestation of God. I offer everything. Fourth part of the prayer is offer everything to the other side. My friends on the other side. See, most in our culture, we don't have much connection to the other side because we don't relate to it. We just think, well, maybe it's there, maybe it's not. Whatever, I'm going to go do what I'm going to do. And people die and we forget about it. Probably at age two, they're starting to remember the other side and they offer everything in their heart to the other side. So when you're offering everything in your heart to the other side, that light is not so far away. That light is with you. The other side is always feeding you. Our angels, our guides, so many angels. And so doing this prayer and doing this practice through the years, the angels become very real. This helps us to be naked. See, in our culture, we can't be naked unless you have a big heart practice. You can have a big house, but it doesn't work. If you have a big heart practice, you can be angels, you can be naked, and then you have the angels, you have your spirit guides, you have your ancestors supporting you on the other side, you have the whole awareness of God supporting you, which is love with 1,000 arms and 1,000 hearts. That is who we really are. And the more we experience who we really are, the more a challenge it is to live in this culture. Because I'm still American from Denver, Colorado. That it's very deep inside of us and never leaves us. And so this is one of the challenges, one of the other practices besides this prayer. The prayer, by the way, is the fifth part of the prayer is once again they remember emptiness. So it begins with emptiness and ends with emptiness. That is very profound. In our culture, there's hardly anybody talking about emptiness. When you go deep into Buddhism, there's some talk about emptiness. But they don't really teach that mindfulness comes from emptiness. Not mindfulness comes from emptiness, but compassion comes from emptiness. If you try compassion just out of your normal personality, not much happens. I mean, I feel sorry for you, but, you know, you could probably do better. I mean, our personality reacts. You know, you can't practice compassion out of your personality. It's very hard. Compassion actually is understanding with a very deep heart. This deep heart comes from our heart practice. It comes out of a great, profound emptiness. Now, this big emptiness, then you can really have compassion for each other and ourselves. Same in Christianity, you know. In Christianity, they talk about forgiveness. But as a personality, it's very hard to be forgiving. I mean, okay, I forgive you, but I don't really forgive you. Or I'm trying to forgive you, but it's not so easy. You know, the personality has troubles. And then in the New Testament, it says Peter asked Jesus, what is forgiveness? And do I forgive 7 times? And Jesus says, no, you forgive 7 times 70. 7 times 70 leads us into the real forgiveness, which is this infinite light. In this infinite light, it is 7 times 70 forgiveness. That's our true awareness, is 7 times 70. So the heart practices and the religions that they're taught mostly come from the heads, and our head can only do so much without a heart practice. And in Western culture, we don't realize how intellectual we become and how separate from our hearts. Anyway, in Bali, they're doing this prayer beginning at age 2. At age 2 in the West, we're hoping our kids can now read and do a little bit of arithmetic. They are not remembering emptiness. And they're not pouring out their hearts to God and to all the manifestations of God, to their ancestors, and remembering emptiness again. So imagine being raised with that awareness. And our friends, our Balinese friends, are very smart. But there's a big difference. In their culture, they pray to the talent of each person. That you will come to your talent, and that's your life path. And we are lucky to come to our talent in this culture. There's no support for that. So Balinese culture, they're doing that prayer, and they're praying to the talent of each person. And so Bali is full of artists of all kinds. It's an incredible place. And the other thing in Bali, and this is what we celebrate every day, they have a day of silence. The whole island becomes quiet where they're just doing that prayer. Imagine, I imagine this day of silence in San Francisco. In Bali, the airport, they have a huge international airport. It's like JFK, it's brand new. The airport goes silent. The whole city goes silent. There's no TV, there's no radio, there's no internet, there's no cars, only ambulances. The island goes silent. And even the Muslims and Christians, the other people of other faiths, they honor that day for the Balinese. In Bali, the public explanation is that we're giving back to the nature this day. But it's really much deeper than that. Silence is a profound home. San Francisco goes silent completely for one day. We will know San Francisco found its home. All these years, I've never had a job since I met that shaman. I've just traveled on the road. I was always going to where we were invited, mostly all over Europe. And it's just recently I'm blessed that we have our own house and we invite people to come to our own center. But that I was on the road for 40 years, sharing and being with people in our nakedness, our trust, our heart practices, and this profound light. So after these years, we teach a meditation. It's very simple. People come and visit us, and we just encourage them to be in complete silence for the entire time, because then the mind is not so busy. It gets a little softer. And silence, we listen to the quiet of our own heart. Sit together for a few minutes and offer everything that keeps us busy. You know, we all have very human lives. We all have challenges. We just offer that for a few minutes. We practice letting it go. That is in the heart, that is inside our hearts. You don't want to watch it. You want to receive it. Receive the quiet that is inside. Out of our heart is a very big presence. It's full of light. Deep as you can into the quiet of your own heart. So, you know, Bruce, what is it like after 40 years when this strange woman took you to the other side? I mean, what's life about? Sponge, a human sponge, where I just soak as much as I can in the heart of life. Come to retreats with us. They say, well, what kind of teachings do you give? You know, what's your technique? Well, my technique is a sponge technique. You want to be in your heart, in the silence and the quiet of your heart, and be a sponge. You want to absorb the light. Sponge gives it out. But you can't give it out until you absorb it. In my humble opinion, most of the teachers, we have not absorbed enough. So the New Age teachers, all the religions, they're talking about the light. But we have a lot of absorption to do. We need to connect heaven to earth. And you can't do that actually. We do it through our heart. We grow into this huge heart. It's without end. So when I grow up, I want to become a better sponge. Just absorb. Being a human sponge is very special, you know, because the sponge part is the human part, you know, that doesn't go away. So we absorb it through our nervous system. We absorb it through my wife, you know, absorb it through our children. Sponge. You want to absorb the light as much as you can in every way it comes. Each of us are full of heaven. We are heaven. Get out of your culture, you feel more free. So we're in Europe. Sacred places. We don't have it so much here. We have beautiful places in nature, but Assisi and all these sacred places through the Holy Mother and stuff, they have these sacred places. So another heart practice is listening for your own sacred place that touches you deeply. America is mostly with a special friend or maybe a location, or we go to Mount Shasta, it's very special. But Bali, we keep going back to Bali because the whole island has this energy. So you want to feed your heart. And that's the last practice I want to share with you. Daily, you want to feed your heart. Shelter in your heart, protect your heart, understand. Listen to that, because that's pure food. And the purest food is our own heart essence. So that's why after all these years, it's all we do. We sit in silence on this mountaintop near Vacaville and receiving your heart essence. It's a light. It's like 1,000 suns. It's so bright. You want to feed. Our culture, we have everything, but our hearts are so dry. People are so lonely. So many people are on drugs or doing stupid things. So much drama. It's in the culture. We're so intellectually full and heart dry. And so you really want to feed your heart deeply. Here, receiving your heart essence through this meditation. So feed your heart. Go there. You know, feed your. How our angels and our guides, they move us, they guide us. They want us to feed our hearts because heaven and earth are coming together. We are all becoming. People go home from our retreats and they say, well, what did you learn from this doctor? He says, I don't know. All he talked about was being a sponge. It was a little bit strange. But I can't help it, you know. You got to have some fun in this life. And if you can become a good sponge, there's nothing more. Support you all deeply in your sponge life. Western culture, there's not much example for receiving the divine feminine. We have Mary, a few saints, a few female prophets. There's not much example. So my wife has gone very deep. It's appropriate that she shares it through movement. So we're going to take a walk in silence, and then we're going to come back, and she's going to share with you sponge through movement.
So for those of you that would like to join in the movement, we're going to do it out here in the middle of the floor. And if you don't want to do the movement, you can just sit in your chair as well. There's no obligation. Okay, so just everybody spread out. You can stay in the meditation because the movement is actually a meditation if you want to just sit in your chair. Yeah, just everybody spread out. Give yourself enough room. So back when Bruce and I were living in Assisi, Assisi is all about everybody doing their practice, and many people from many religions come to Assisi just to be there in the energy and to do their practice. There would be Sufis, whirling dervishes, Buddhists, Rinpoches coming in with their groups, the Hare Krishnas, you know, everybody comes to Assisi because Francis had this open heart to all people. And so I wanted to dive into my Hinduism and my study of the Divine Mother. And in that practice, I wanted to stay in for a whole year. I wanted to just stay with the Divine Mother in her many forms, Tara, Lakshmi, Kali. And I didn't want to read about her. I wanted to feel, invite her presence to be with me, however that might be, and just be open to it. I didn't know what it would be. And again, pouring my heart out in devotion, in any part practice of pouring your heart out in devotion, that being that you are pouring your heart out to, that creates the bridge of communication. So as I pour my heart out in devotion, that being comes and can be present with you and start to communicate with you. And so that's what happened. I did this practice for, I was in about a year-long practice, taking one mother for 1 month, Tara for a whole month, Lakshmi for a whole month, Kali for a whole month. And I just invited them to be with me. I don't know. You know, I'm not going to read about them. I'm just going to invite. So I just watched what would happen. In the 6th month of my practice, there were many interesting things that happened, but in the 6th month of my practice, the movement ritual came. And it's an embodiment of the divine feminine. What happened is I realized that each movement was actually another voice from another mother. So I will share which mother it is in each movement. But it is, each movement is just a doorway into the study, profounder and deeper study of that mother. Any one of the mothers is a complete spiritual practice. This particular practice that I'm going to share with you is really the wisdom goddesses from Yoga Tantra. There's one thing I want to teach you before we actually start the movement, and that's a Tai Chi practice. And it's about moving awareness, because actually what we're doing in our meditation practice is we're moving our awareness from our mental activity, and we're coming into spaciousness. We're moving away from tight form and fixed tension, and we're withdrawing into vast spaciousness. And this is a heart practice. And so what I'm going to do is we're going to actually do it physically just to understand how we're moving energy. So first we stand with both feet on the floor, perfectly balanced. In Qigong, this means we have evenly divided qi in both legs. And then we just slowly move our weight into one leg. Move it into your right leg, your standing leg. We are shifting the chi into the standing leg. We're re-emptying the chi out of the left leg. Now our right leg is full of chi, and the left leg is empty. The right leg is still there. The left leg is still there, but it's not relevant. So all of our energy, our awareness has moved into the right leg. The left leg is still there, but it's not relevant to this movement. So when we move our awareness from the mental activity and we withdraw it into the vastness of the heart, we're completely full in vastness. Now the mind is still there. It's just not relevant to this space. So what happens is we get into this vast awareness and we're going along fine and everything is, wow, it's so incredible in here. And I've moved my awareness and I'm in there. And suddenly, yeah, but did you remember? Don't forget. And then the mind goes off, right? That's because we are so practiced in going into that mental space, we immediately jump back to it. It's just that we aren't practiced in staying in the infinite space. After a while, it becomes boring. We go, ah, I think I'll go over there and think about what I need to do. I have so many things to do. Right, so that's what happens. The mind is trained to jump out and go after what it knows. It isn't trained, practiced to just stay in infinite love, bliss, peace, sincerity, whatever it is. Each one feels it differently inside. But the idea is to get into that space of infinite presence. It's the presence of your own being. And that's why Bruce kept saying, absorb it, receive it. Let go of the mental world. Let it go. Come in to the vast heart space and just be a sponge and receive. So that's what we're doing. We're shifting our awareness from the mental, tight, sticky, grabby awareness. We're letting go and we're coming into infinite presence. I explain this as yin-yang. The yang part of our mind is that outward-focused, get it done, figure it out, do it, get it done now. That's the yang part of the mind. The yin is the inner world. Vast, open, free, giving. It has everything. Full potential, all life. And so that's what we're doing in heart practice and in meditation, is we're reaching into our spirit, our heart essence, and we're staying there as long as we can. Most of us have 98% yang developed and 2% yin. And that's why we struggle. Because we are so caught up in controlling and managing and manipulating outer life. And we don't even know about yin. I don't know. It's that we don't have time for it. Yeah, I don't know. But if we can step into that yin and open up to it and spread it out, give it space, support it, make it real, live in it, dance in it, sing from it, do whatever, make love in it, just be in that spaciousness of being. That's developing the yin. Now what happens when we have suddenly 50% yang and 50% yin? We've just now healed 48%, this is a made up, of course, of the yang. We've healed it by developing the yin. What does that look like? Could be, oh, I I have so much more patience with those people. I can communicate better with my boss and my friends. Oh, I'm not so reactive anymore. Or, oh, I've got an amazing idea for something else, right? So this is the yin. This is why it's so important. The yang is our intellect. The yin is our wisdom. The yang is our humanness. The yin is our divinity. That's why it's very important to develop the yin. Because when we project the pure awareness into the yang experience, our body, our personality, our ego, we get out here and we go, oh my God, this is all there is to life. This is my job. This is my husband. This is my work. I hate those people. We become reactionary out here. When our pure awareness is out, projected through our ego and our body and our experience, we think this is all there is. It's about pulling it back to its original nature, pulling the awareness into itself, free, open, vast. In here, I'm naturally compassionate. Out here, I have to try to be compassionate. I really should be nicer to those people. I really hate those people. In here, I'm in my wisdom. I'm naturally compassionate. I can be open. I can be friendly. Right? Because there's no separate. Out here is separateness. In here is unity. This is tight and small. This is wide open like this, like the sky. That's why it's so important to get out into nature. So there's things that support the yin. Nature, retreats, meditation, spa day, a beautiful conversation with a wonderful friend, whatever it is, but we want to expand that yin. So that's what we're doing in heart practice. That's what we're doing in meditation. Back to the movement. I caught off on. Okay, so that was very important to understand that we can shift our awareness into our beingness. We can still be aware of our mental activity, but we can be completely standing in our being, our wisdom. So we're going to begin this practice. It's a series of 9 movements. Can I take a sip of water? Is that water? So as you can see, I discovered this meditation space through dance. So as a small child, the second I got out into a beautiful floor like this, I look at this floor and I go, oh my God, this is amazing. Oh, because, you know, you get out there and they go, well, now the girl, don't look down at your feet. You know, look up, look, look, look up. I went, oh my God. Oh. All beauty, it's all love. It's everything. So I became an incredible dancer. I love to dance. So this is why the dance was so important to my spiritual practice and why at some point it all came together through this movement practice to the Divine Mother. So even though this looks like an outer practice, it's actually an inner practice. It's a series of 9 movements. Each movement has a words, a phrase that go with it. If some word doesn't fit with your experience, just let it go or change. It doesn't matter. There's nothing to memorize. You're just following along. It doesn't have to look exactly like mine. If you feel something different, do that. It's all done in standing position. The last movement is done kneeling, going into child's pose. But if that is uncomfortable for any part of your body, please sit on a chair. It's not important. We're not accomplishing a physical feat. We're just doing a meditative movement. We begin by, before we begin the actual movement, we're going to bring up the earth into the body, into the heart, into the awareness, and back down on an out-breath. Coming up, breathing in, bringing the quality of the earth up into the body, heart, and awareness. The quality of the earth might be stability, groundedness, depth. In your own rhythm of breath, it may not look like mine. And then, in between each movement, stand with your hands at your sides. We're coming back to effortless being. Again, there's this contrast between effort and effortlessness, yang, yin. Effortless being is the infinite expansive self. Naturally here, nothing to do. And then starting at the heart, breathing in, going up into the sky, bringing the quality of the sky down on an out-breath. Into the heart, into the awareness. Breathing in, going up into the sky, bringing the quality of the sky into the mind, body, heart, awareness. It might feel like openness, spaciousness, freedom, joyfulness. You're just noticing. Coming back to effortless being. Bruce referred to it as emptiness. So at each point between the movements, there's complete emptiness. The awareness of presence, aliveness. Bringing our hands to our heart, we hold the earth in our left hand, the sky in our right. We are both, we have both. We need both. And from here, we begin the practice. I feel the presence of peace directly in front of me, inside of me. The very heart of love is directly in front of me, inside of me. And in humility, I step inside. I take a step forward, outwardly and inwardly. I am standing in the presence of peace. I am completely seen and loved. I am safe, and I am home. Bhuvaneshwari, the womb of God, completely held, protected. Next, just follow along. I am thankful for my practice. I am thankful that I remembered my practice and that I'm able to do it. Back to effortless being. This is the wisdom of Tara. Next, I bring in all the beauty that is around me into my heart. And from there, it flows through my entire body. Four more times, your own rhythm. Bring in all the colors, all of nature, all the fresh prana. Being in your own heart, bring in the abundance of beauty that's inside your own heart. Spread through your whole body, through every cell. This is the wisdom of Lakshmi. I am a wave. I flow with the rhythm of my own life. Now, this is a perfect expression of yin-yang. Yin disappears, lowers down. Fills, comes up, gives way to yang, pressing out, pushing. Yang gives way to yin, thinning out, disappearing, gives way. Other side, same thing. I flow with the rhythm of the moon and the stars. I am time itself. Manifest time reminds me I am eternity. Next, bring your hands together very slowly. At some point, you might feel a slight bit of resistance. This is the chi energy, the pranic life force. I hold a ball of healing light in front of me, and inside, I will move my hands like a butterfly for transformation. I untie the knots of my attachments. I transform myself. I take it into my body. And I am becoming free. The true self is already free. Next, I do that very same movement once in front of my heart and once in front of my head. I hold a ball of healing light in front of me, and inside I will move my hands like a butterfly. I untie the knots of my emotions. This is the yang energy. I transform myself. I take it into my body, and I am becoming. The true self is already free. I untie the knots of my ego and my thoughts. I transform myself. I take it into my body. And I am becoming. Yourself. Is already free. This is the wisdom of Chinnamasta. The wave in the last movement was Kali. Next. I am one with everything I see. I am one with everything unseen. And then with that same thought, I make a complete circle in each direction. Coming all the way back to the center of your heart, getting as tiny as possible, to the size of a grain of sand, diminishing the outer world. From here, we're going to expand inwardly as we expand outwardly. I imagine the ocean out in front of me. And as I stretch out my hands, I stretch out my heart to touch the horizon. Where water and sky meet, this is the doorway into heaven. I leave my heart there. As I open my arms, my mind expands to become one with the sky. My body expands to become one with the ocean. My mind is still, and time stops. When we feel the expanding presence within, the mind naturally stops. This is the wisdom of Bhagala. And I am as deep as the ocean itself. Pause between the movement is the great silence. It's the wisdom of Dhumavati. These wisdoms live inside of us. They're not separate from us. The Mother teaches us we already have them all within, inside our heart, our bodies, our minds. Next. I gather all the sweet golden nectar that is falling from heaven. It is constantly falling. It is grace. I bring it in through the top of my head. It flows down through my body. I bring it in front of my heart, and the bird of my heart drinks from it. Two more times, your own rhythm. Nectar of grace, peace, love is constantly flowing. It's constantly feeding us in our heart. Feel it pouring down your back, your front, down the center of your body. Down your torso, your arms, your legs, out your fingers and toes and feet. Feeding all beings. As we receive the grace, we receive it for everyone. And everything. The wisdom of Sundari. The last movement is done kneeling, but as I said before, if this is uncomfortable for any part of your body, please find a chair to sit down on or sit on the ground. Imagine a beautiful river flowing out in front of you. I always imagine myself back at the Ganges, the Mother River. You want to imagine a beautiful river, full, deep, rich, clear, giving, holy. I am sitting with the Mother River. She is the giver of all life, and I give everything back to her. I hold on to nothing. Radiant light of my being is within me. She washes me, and she takes the world from me. Whenever we go to the holy water, anywhere in the world, we go to be cleansed, to be refreshed, to be released, to be renewed. Water washes us, bathes us, takes all our troubles away. At the same time, we go to receive the blessing. Let the water dry on us, into us, soak into us. We continue to receive the blessing of this moment, this day, this lifetime. This is the wisdom of the Mother River. When we give everything away, she gives everything back to us. And I am thankful for my practice. I am thankful for everyone and everything. I am thankful for everyone and everything. The wisdom of Tara. Comfortably to close, just for a couple of minutes, and then find your way back to your meditation mat or chair, and we're going to sit for another 20 minutes or so, just receiving the ongoing blessings of this moment, this day, this lifetime. We end as we began, in the very heart of love, the presence of peace, completely seen, completely loved, completely safe, and at home. The wisdom of Bhuvaneshwari.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.